Palestinians in the occupied West Bank have staged demonstrations to condemn Israel's deadly aggression against the Gaza Strip. Israeli warplanes and artillery keep pounding the Gaza Strip as the Palestinian death toll tops 210, almost half of them women and children. And Palestinian resistance forces target two Israeli settlements and a military post, retaliation for Israeli attacks on Gaza. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Palestinians in the occupied West Bank have staged demonstrations to condemn Israel's deadly aggression against the Gaza Strip. People took to the streets in the cities of Ramallah and Hebron, also known as Al-Khalil, in their thousands. A general strike has also taken place across the West Bank and East Jerusalem Al-Quds. The aim is to protest Israel's atrocities against Palestinians in the occupied territories and to show solidarity with the people of Gaza. On Monday, Palestinians in the West Bank held similar marches that turned violent after Israeli forces attacked protesters. Meanwhile, security remains tight in the occupied territories after two stabbing attacks that occurred Tuesday and the day before. Israeli forces shot and killed two Palestinians involved in the incidents. Let's bring in Sami Hamdi, Editor-in-Chief of the International Interest, who joins us from London to have his take on what is going on. Sami Hamdi, at this point, a general strike is taking place today in occupied Palestine. And from what it looks like in occupied Ramallah, the tensions are obviously very high. How do you assess the situation in the occupied territories when there are tensions the way that it is? I mean, are we looking at realistically a third intifada taking place?
I think, yes, we are looking at a third intifada. I think it's important to stress that this is the first time that the Palestinians have scored two very important victories and delivered two heavy defeats on Israel that it will never recover from. The first is that the Palestinians have successfully broken Israel's monopoly over the narrative and discourse with which we talk about the conflict, and that's as a result of this being the first war taking place in the midst of social media being in its prime, and also in the midst of a Palestinian generation that has grown up under social media and become very attuned and accustomed to social media that has enabled them to bypass the monopoly on information that Israel and other mainstream media have had in order to deliver the videos and deliver their narrative and deliver their stories to millions of people around the world who have reshared and retweeted and essentially put those images out, such that Benny Gantz, the Israeli defense minister, was so concerned about it that he ordered a meeting with Facebook and TikTok executives demanding that they take down pro-Palestine content. And this is why now with this decentralization of communication, the Palestinians in the 1948 borders, the Palestinians in the 1967 borders in these occupied territories, the Palestinians in Gaza and the Palestinians in West Bank now have a form of free-flowing communication whereby what happens in Al-Aqsa encourages the people in Gaza, encourages the people in the West Bank. And that's why we're seeing this concerted effort in terms of how the Palestinians are moving forward, how they're mobilizing in order essentially to put this significant pressure on Israel. And this is why I think that it is an intifada, because these two victories that they have secured, these two defeats they have delivered on Israel, will have severe repercussions on the Israeli leverage on the peace process and how we talk about the conflict moving on from here. We're now seeing the words apartheid and the words occupation being used in the American Congress through the likes of AOC, through Ilhan Omar, through Rashida Tlaib. And this is unprecedented. And this means that when we look at the trajectory of how we are talking about the conflict, the reality is now it is moving towards a trajectory whereby Israel no longer dominates the discourse. And we even saw on channels such as Sky News when the Israeli ambassador sought to assert that the UN should get involved and condemn Hamas and condemn the Palestinians, the Sky News presenter, Sky News, which is typically more aligned towards the Israeli narrative, the presenter turned around and said it's a bit hypocritical and ironic that the Israeli ambassador, Israel, that ignores the UN on a regular basis, is now calling on the UN to do something. So I think in this regard, we are seeing an intifada that will have lasting repercussions. And the second defeat that they've inflicted on Israel in this intifada is that they have decimated this image of Israel being this invincible moral army, so invincible that the Palestinians had no choice but to roll over and accept their conditions. Now that the rockets have penetrated the Iron Dome, now that the Palestinians in the 1948 borders in Lod and Ascalon have come out and have protested and have rioted, demanding either they get their justice or equal rights, it's becoming abundantly clear that Israel is no longer this invincible force, and that it is increasingly in the eyes of public opinion an apartheid state. And it is in this context we should look at what's taking place in Ramallah, what's taking place in terms of the general strike. Because while the West Bank, the Palestinian Authority, was slow to adapt to what was going on in the occupied territories and in Gaza, it's becoming clear that their mobilization is reflective of an appreciation that there is an irresistible wave that they cannot not be a part of. They must move and align with it. I'm talking about the Palestinian Authority here. And the people in Ramallah, of course, they want to support, they want to push forward because they believe that this is a unified resistance. And the final thing I will say on this point is that what this intifada is showing is that now the Palestinian factions that have traditionally been divided and therefore harmed the Palestinian cause, now that there has been this sudden unity of resistance that has gained so much traction and so much had such an impact on Israel, these parties will have no choice but to come together in a unity government and come together in some sort of a unified front in order to really maximize the potential opportunities and advantages that have been presented by this I would say unprecedented intifada, insofar as it has broken Israel's monopoly on the narrative.
Thank you very much for that. Sami Hamdi, Editor-in-Chief, The International Interest. Many thanks. Fresh protests have taken place, meanwhile, in several countries against the ongoing Israeli aggression against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Iranian students gathered in the capital, Tehran, to show support for Palestinians and to condemn the Israeli aggression. In Indonesia, people were out on the streets of the capital, Jakarta, solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza and Jerusalem al-Quds. And in Argentina, demonstrators marched on the Israeli embassy in Buenos Aires to protest the regime's strikes on the Gaza Strip. Cities across the globe, including Washington, D.C., London, and Istanbul, have witnessed rallies over the past week as Israel has ramped up its attacks against Palestinians. Israel pounds the Gaza Strip with fresh airstrikes and shelling from land and sea as the regime's deadly onslaught of besieged Palestinian territory enters its second week. The latest attacks hit residential buildings near the main hospital in the Gaza Strip, as well as a site near the Islamic University in western Gaza. Israeli media say 65 targets in the cities of Gaza and Khan Yunis were hit within half an hour. The regime's artillery also shelled the eastern parts of the city of Rafah and the southern Gaza Strip. The Israeli onslaught has killed 212 Gazans since it began last Monday. The dead include 61 children and 36 women. The indiscriminate bombing has also destroyed 800 buildings in Gaza and damaged 10,000 more structures. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent in Gaza, Ashraf Shannon, who gave us an update on the Israeli aggressions.
Minutes ago, less than 5 minutes ago, Israeli fighter jets, I believe F-35 fighter jets, fired at least 10 rockets not far from where we're standing right now. We are in front of the emergency room of Al-Shifa Hospital. This is the main hospital, the main health provider for the entire Gaza Strip. And over the past few days, several explosions happened here. Earlier in the morning, a building not far from here, about a couple hundred yards, was bombed and completely destroyed. And many buildings there were also sustained either complete or partial damage. The airstrikes continue, not only in Gaza. The ones that we hear, and the bombings that we count, is what we have in Gaza City. The Israeli fighter jets, the Israeli tanks, are hitting almost every town in the Gaza Strip as we speak, including Khan Yunis, Beth Lahia in the north, Beth Hanun in the north, Barej, Nazirat, Rafah. Every town and village in Gaza is under Israeli attack. Almost every minute, every hour, there is a bombing somewhere. There is a tank shelling somewhere. And if it's not tanks, they're using the navy to fire its shells towards the coast of the Gaza Strip. Since yesterday, maybe at least 100 shells were fired at the coastline. Even earlier tonight, about an hour and a half, an hour ago, I was counting maybe 50 shells hitting the coast, not far from here. Shifa Hospital is adjacent to a Shati refugee camp. Shati is the...
That was a big explosion.
Shati is a... Yes. Shati is the Arabic word for beach, the beach refugee camp. It's not far from here, but 300 yards behind me is the Shati refugee camp.
Palestinian resistance groups have launched fresh attacks on Israel in retaliation for the regime's onslaught on the Gaza Strip. Hamas's military wing said it has targeted an Israeli military site east of Gaza with mortar shells. The Zaidin al-Bassam brigades also fired missiles into the Israeli cities of Okfim and Netivot. Before that, the group fired rockets into Sderot and hit a gathering of Israeli soldiers near the city. Other Israeli cities, including Ashkelon and Beersheba, as well as several military bases, were targeted also. In the past days, Palestinian rocket attacks also hit Tel Aviv. Resistance groups have promised more attacks if Israel does not stop its airstrikes on Gaza. So far, 10 Israelis have been killed and hundreds injured by Palestinian attacks. A senior medic in the Gaza Strip says the health system in the besieged Palestinian territory is struggling amid the deadly Israeli aggression and the coronavirus crisis.
The Ministry of Health is fighting on two fronts in the Gaza Strip, the coronavirus front and the other, which is more challenging, the injuries and the wounded in the Shifa Hospital and other hospitals in the Gaza Strip.
The remarks come as Shifa Hospital, the biggest health facility in Gaza, doubled the number of intensive care beds to cope with the rising number of wounded Palestinians. However, the coastal enclave is facing acute shortage of medicines and equipment, which medics blame on years of Israeli blockade. Local authorities have also warned that Gaza's only COVID-19 laboratory is no longer able to carry out testing due to an Israeli airstrike. The World Health Organization has already condemned the flare-up in Gaza, saying the protection of health workers and infrastructure is imperative in all circumstances.
Protection of health workers and health facilities is an imperative in all circumstances. It's essential that the norms of international humanitarian law be fully respected. In particular, health workers and infrastructure should always be protected, and I call
The WHO chief made the remarks as Israeli warplanes and artillery continue to pound Gaza that has so far killed scores of Palestinians. Other than the rising death toll, the Israeli bombardment on civilian areas has displaced tens of thousands of people. Some 2,500 Gazans have now turned homeless. Over a week of Israeli attacks have also battered crucial infrastructure, with the electricity authority warning that it would run out of fuel in a couple of days. Monster cyclone Tokte has killed at least 24 people in India. The cyclone has battered parts of the vast nation, sending huge waves crashing onto its shores. It also turned streets into rivers and forced hundreds of thousands of people to flee. Savage winds swept through flimsy homes and uprooted trees, as well as electricity pylons. Authorities in Mumbai have closed the city's airport and urged people to stay indoors. Meanwhile, 96 people went missing after a vessel adrift off Mumbai's coast sank during the cyclone. That's the biggest to hit India in decades. The cyclone has interrupted the COVID-19 vaccine program there. Munawar Zaman says the second coronavirus wave is yet to peak in India, despite measures to curb the spread of the virus.
Well, the situation has somehow been under control over the last 3 or 4 days. What we say under control doesn't mean the COVID has started retreating, but yes, the number of active cases is dropping to a marginal level. But at the same time, the death toll is climbing. What we are talking about, these are those people who were already admitted in the hospitals in the different places. And that's the reason why we are seeing a phenomenal rise in the death toll. And this death toll is expected to rise further in the coming weeks. What we see in the change in trends, for example, the drop in cases, is because of the fact that the countries, many states of the countries, have announced their own measures, such as lockdowns and restrictions. That has helped the country to contain the spread to some extent. But let me tell you that this is not the peak. We are yet to wait. We are still waiting for second wave peak, which scientists believe is the month of August.
Turkey has eased its virus restrictions from Monday as new cases of COVID-19 decline following the 3-week lockdown in the country. Russian Saglam has more.
Turkey started a normalization phase after 3 weeks of lockdown. A 15-day long period of eased but not lifted restrictions has started in the country as daily numbers of new infected started falling. Due to the measures taken during the holy month of Ramadan, the numbers decreased from 60,000 per day to something near 10,000. Turkish president said the country hoped to overcome this pandemic as the new waves across the world has badly affected the situation in Turkey. He also stressed the importance of taking the vaccine to overcome this phase so that Turkey could go back to normal life soon.
Normalleşme adımlarını atıyoruz.
We start implementing our normalization calendar as of Monday. The restrictions will be eased in phases until the end of May and significantly as of June.
Experts say that the gradual normalization would not result in another increase in the numbers of daily infections. They also advise citizens to minimize their home visits to relatives and friends, as well as stay away from shopping malls and crowded areas.
The number of daily infection cases has reached a logical point, paving the way for easing the lockdown. We need to ease the lockdown to make a balance between containing the spread of the virus and allowing our people to go back to work and get prepared to welcome tourists. Our economy has been negatively affected with the lockdowns over the past year. We are trying to continue with the vaccination campaign. The government is now trying to get more vaccine jabs.
Most of the travel restrictions will be lifted, but nighttime and weekend curfews will remain in place, and restaurants will only open for food deliveries. With the new measures, Turkey hopes to compensate the economic losses it sustained over the past year. If tourists don't return to Turkish beaches this year, the nation's current account balance and lira are likely to be hit. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on May 7, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution on the occasion of the International Al-Quds Day. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, in his speech on the occasion of International Quds Day, referring to the change in the balance of power in favor of Islamic world and Palestine, emphasized, "I tell you with confidence the downward movement of the Zionist regime has started and will not stop."
Another noteworthy point is that although that the usurping regime was established in 1948, the ground for occupying that sensitive Islamic region had been prepared years before that. Those specific years coincided with the active interference of Westerners in Islamic countries with the purpose of establishing secularism, an excessive and blind nationalism, and also with the goal of installing despotic governments who were infatuated with or controlled by the West. Studying those events in Iran, Turkey, and Arab countries, stretching from West Asia to North Africa, reveals this bitter truth that weakness and discord in the Islamic Ummah paved the way for the disastrous usurpation of Palestine, allowing the world of arrogance to deliver that blow to the Islamic Ummah.
Every day we tell each other that this day will be the last, and tomorrow we all can go home free, and all this will finally end. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free.
It is instructive that at that time, the capitalism and communism camps colluded with the rich Zionists. It was the English who masterminded the plot and who persisted in it, and then Zionist capitalists executed it with their money and weapons. The Soviet Union too was one of the first governments that officially recognized the establishment of that illegitimate regime, and later on dispatched a large number of Jews to that area. The usurping regime was actually an outcome of that situation in the world of Islam, on the one hand, and of a European plot, invasion and transgression on the other. Today, the situation in the world is not like those days. We should keep this reality within sight. Today, the balance of power has swung in favor of the world of Islam. Various political and social incidents in Europe and in the United States have laid bare the weaknesses and the deep structural, managerial and moral conflicts among Westerners.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
On May 15, 1948, the regime forced some 750,000 Palestinians to leave their homes and villages and expelled them into refugee camps that still exist in the occupied West Bank, Gaza, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. Armed forces massacred entire villages of men, women, and even children. That pushed rightful owners of Palestine to leave their homes and lands as they feared losing their lives. Consequently, that provided the ground for Zionists to establish the Israeli regime. The Palestinians were to suffer further when the West Bank and Gaza fell to the Israelis during the Six-Day War in 1967. Millions of Palestinians, including those displaced since 1948, found themselves under military occupation as well as further Israeli expansionism in their lands. In 2020, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu unveiled his intention to annex the occupied West Bank with the support of the United States. The move is widely condemned as it is considered illegal and in defiance of international law. For many Palestinians, that is just the last chapter in a process that started with the initial loss of their lands in 1948. More than 600,000 Israelis currently live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the West Bank and East Jerusalem Al-Quds. That's while all Israeli settlement activities are illegal under international law. Every year, Palestinians reaffirm their right to return to their homes and villages in historic Palestine on Nakba Day. They hold annual rallies to commemorate decades of ethnic cleansing of their homeland by its regime to establish what's known today as Israel. This year, Palestinians and their supporters across the globe mark the day amid Israel's deadly aggression against Palestinians in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip.
The Israeli government is taking more land in the West Bank. More than two-thirds of the West Bank has been swallowed by the Israeli settlements. And every day they are also taking more land in Jerusalem. As we have seen in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, they are kicking Palestinians out of their hands, of their homes and lands in order to replace them with Israeli, with Jewish settlers. It will continue because the Palestinians are not willing to surrender to the Israeli to the Israeli policies of ethnic cleansing.
In a pre-dawn airstrike, Israeli warplanes attacked Al-Shati refugee camp in western Gaza on Saturday. 8 children and 2 women were killed while 15 others were injured. Following that, Hamas's military wing, the Izzeddin al-Qassam Brigades, said it has fired tens of rockets at Tel Aviv and Ashdod in retaliation for Israel's attacks on the Gaza Strip. The Izzeddin al-Qassam Brigades also said they launched drone and mortar attacks on Israel's Kisafim military base. The group has announced it is prepared to bomb Tel Aviv for 6 months in a row. Hamas has recently stepped up attacks on Israel in response to the regime's aggression on the besieged territory. Israel's Ramon Airport, as well as cities of Ashkelon and Ashdod, have also come under missile attacks in the past few days. On Saturday afternoon, the Israeli regime also flattened the 11-story Al Jalal building that housed the offices of Al Jazeera and the Associated Press News Agency. Press freedom advocates sharply condemned the move, calling it a brazen attempt to silence journalists covering the Israeli military's ongoing offensive that has killed scores of people.
They will continue to do so because they are launching a war against not only the Palestinian people but also against the media that is showing the real Israeli face and real Israeli violations of human rights.
Targeting the media organizations and journalists in Israeli military offensives in the Gaza Strip isn't an accident. This is systematic targeting of media in Gaza in order to prevent reporting from there and to create a cloak of secrecy around Israeli crimes.
Gaza and the other Palestinian territories have been simmering with anger over Israel's stepped-up land-grab policies in occupied Jerusalem al-Quds, as well as the regime's desecration of the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex, one of the holiest sites in Islam. Days after the regime launched a heavy-handed crackdown on Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque during the holy fasting month of Ramadan, tensions spiraled into a broader conflict between Gaza and Israel. Since last Monday, the Israeli military has been launching large-scale airstrikes against Gaza, razing many homes and civilian infrastructure to the ground. The regime's artillery and tanks have also been targeting the blockaded coastal enclave, killing and injuring scores of people, including women and children. Meanwhile, the Palestinian resistance groups have been responding to Israel's acts of aggression with massive barrages of rockets and missiles. They have also brought drones into the equation. Much to Israel's surprise, rocket launches have largely overwhelmed the regime's anti-missile system, dubbed the Iron Dome, and hit several cities across the occupied territories, leaving several dead and dozens of others injured.
So, of course, the Zionists have always believed that they have been protected behind what they called an Iron Dome, that missile defense shield that they believed would defend them from all attacks, either from Palestinian resistance forces or from the wider Arab and Islamic world, such as Syria, Lebanon, and Iran. Now, we have seen, of course, that this Iron Dome is more like an iron sieve nowadays, because the amount of missiles, hundreds and hundreds of missiles that have gotten through and have landed, some of them in strategic places such as cities near the Gaza Strip or near Ben Gurion Airport in the occupied in the Zionist city of Tel Aviv.
Meanwhile, the regime in Tel Aviv has been under criticism worldwide, with many supporters of the Palestinian cause in Muslim countries and elsewhere holding rallies in solidarity with the Palestinians. As the exchange of fire between the Israeli army and the resistance groups continue, the tensions in the occupied West Bank has reached a fever pitch. So far, several incidents have been recorded where mobs of settlers raided and vandalized Palestinian shops or attacked Palestinian Arabs there.
They are so high up in the clouds, let's say, of their own superiority, of their own master race status, let's say, in the region, that they don't really believe in the possibility of resistance in the region really making a dent in the Zionist armor. And what we have seen now is that there is way more than a dent in the armor. The Palestinians have broken through this armor.
While the Israeli attacks on Palestinians have been met with international condemnation, the United States has stopped short of denouncing the regime's crimes. Washington blocked a UN Security Council meeting on the Palestinian situation and prevented the world body from releasing a statement on the issue, saying that such a move would not be helpful to de-escalation talks with the two sides. Washington's support for the regime has sparked an outcry inside the United States, too. Several Democratic members of the U.S. Congress have lashed out at the regime and slammed the United States' unconditional support for it.
We must condition aid to Israel on compliance with international human rights and end the apartheid. We must, with no hesitation, demand that our country recognize the unconditional support of Israel has enabled the erasure of Palestinian life and the denial of the rights of millions of refugees.
As Israel ramps up its attacks on the people of Palestine, such calls for its boycott are growing stronger. But how many more lives should be lost before the voices are heard?
Iran and the remaining signatories to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action are continuing their talks in Vienna to save the nuclear agreement nearly 3 years after Washington's unilateral withdrawal in 2018. The United States is complicating the negotiations by insisting on keeping in place 500 anti-Iran sanctions, including in the 2015 nuclear deal, officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. Informed sources say if kept in place, the sanctions on these 500 individuals and entities will prevent Iran from doing business with the rest of the world, which is in violation of Article 29 of the agreement. This is while Tehran has time and again reiterated that Washington has to take the first step towards reviving the nuclear deal by unconditionally removing all sanctions in a verifiable manner.
It has been the United States who left the JCPOA, who withdrew from the JCPOA. It is the United States who should come first, who should implement its obligations and lift all of its sanctions. And then Iran would verify, and after upon verification, Iran would restart its obligations in the JCPOA.
Tehran has also reiterated its calls that the United States has to remove not some, but all sanctions on the Islamic Republic.
Well, our position is quite clear. All sanctions should be lifted. All sanctions which are mentioned in the JCPOA, and any new sanctions imposed after the adoption day of the JCPOA, including everything during Trump administration. This is our position, it's quite clear, and we are working to come to a conclusion which meet our demands on the sanctions lifting.
The comments by Araghchi comes as the JCPOA has been in disarray since May 2018 when former U.S. President Donald Trump abandoned the deal and reimposed the anti-Iran sanctions that the JCPOA had removed. The Trump administration has also placed additional sanctions on Iran under other pretexts not related to Iran's nuclear energy program as part of its maximum pressure campaign. The negotiations in Vienna come as the new U.S. administration has expressed readiness to compensate for Trump's mistake and rejoin the deal. It is, however, showing an overriding willingness to maintain some of the sanctions as a tool of pressure. Many believe that the U.S. refusal to remove anti-Iran sanctions would mean the talks are about to fail or have already failed.
I think that we are in a very important situation right now. We will know in the coming days whether the talks will succeed or in fact fail. And the pressure is currently on Washington, because while the Iranian government stands firmly together in their refusal to renegotiate agreements that have been in the works for years now, the American side is completely disorganized, and it's not sure whether President Biden will remain the majority leader in both houses of Congress for the foreseeable future.
Some also believe that there is a possibility that the U.S. will resort to the old tactic of agreeing to a nuclear deal with all of its benefits on paper, yet intimidate other countries from doing business with Iran using the threat of sanctions like it did during the 2015 nuclear agreement. Iran says it will not allow the negotiations to become attritional. Iran's top negotiator in Vienna and Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi says the Islamic Republic would stop the negotiations if it concludes that the other side lacks seriousness, tries to buy time, or seek to add new topics to those under discussion. Iran says the ball is now in the U.S.'s court to return to the agreement and remove all sanctions on Tehran or pursue the failed policy of its predecessor known as Maximum Pressure Campaign and push ahead with its hostile policy against the Islamic Republic. The Biden administration has so far not taken any solid measure to return to the deal over 100 days after it took the helm in Washington. The next 2 weeks will be decisive, and the negotiations could go either way. More attacks by Israeli forces against Palestinians in the occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds. On Monday, over 300 Palestinians were wounded after Israeli troops fired rubber bullets on them around the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Scores were detained by Israeli forces. The protests erupted after Israeli troops stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in an effort to force out the Palestinians. The violence around the mosque and the Old City were the worst since 2017, fueled by a years-long bid by Israeli settlers to take over Palestinian homes in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. The Israeli regime is also celebrating its 1967 occupation of Jerusalem Al-Quds.
There are several facts here. One is that this is a process of, once again, of ethnic cleansing in broad daylight. It is a provocation, obvious provocation against Islam, and has appropriately been denounced by most Arab countries, including a couple of them who are overly anxious to normalize relations with Israel and hopefully will now reconsider what they've done.
Sheikh Ikrima Sabri, the imam and preacher of Al-Aqsa Mosque, has condemned the attack, calling the raid a heinous crime that cannot be tolerated. Leader of the Palestinian National Initiative Party, Mustafa Barghouti, called the Israeli raid on Al-Aqsa Mosque compound a criminal act. Barghouti described the raid as a racist act by an apartheid regime.
Well, Israel is indisputably an apartheid state. It always has been from the outset. From 1948 on, it simply wasn't called that. The apartheid nature of Israel was confirmed in 1967 when it invaded the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem, Mustafa Barghouti is absolutely 100% right when he calls it a criminal act.
The military brigade of the Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, also warned against the presence of Israeli forces in the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The situation is so fluid, and resistance movements fired tens of rockets toward occupied Palestine Monday afternoon. The clashes in Al-Aqsa Mosque have drawn widespread condemnation from the international community. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres urged Israel to cease demolitions and evictions, saying Israeli authorities must exercise maximum restraint. The U.S. government, however, stopped short of condemning the Israeli aggression against Palestinians. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan instead conveyed serious concern to his Israeli counterpart about violent confrontations in Jerusalem al-Quds. Arab nations, including Syria, Iraq, and Qatar, also hit out at Israel over the Jerusalem violence. Some Arab countries, including those that last year normalized relations with Israel, condemned the Israeli aggression. Iran, Pakistan, and many other nations also slammed the attack. In Britain, Germany, Turkey, Jordan, and elsewhere, people took to the streets to condemn the Israeli regime's atrocities and voice solidarity with the Palestinian people. In some countries like Oman, people gathered in front of the Israeli embassy to condemn the raids.
It's clear, I think, to the peoples of the world, even if it's not necessarily to political classes in the Occident, in the West, that the Israeli regime is a criminal entity, and what they're seeing practiced against the Palestinian people, Palestinian worshippers, which is really the reflection of a process that's gone on for far too long and backed by Western governments, specifically Washington and its allies. So there's no surprise in the fact that people everywhere in the world are outraged.
The Israeli desecration of the Al-Aqsa Mosque is nothing new. Israel has done similar acts in the past many times. Tel Aviv has been violating the rights of Palestinians with impunity since its installment in the region by its Western creators. The regime enjoys full support from the U.S. in particular.
The reason that Israel was created in the first place was that it was meant to be a foothold for British expansion into the region, and to the control of oil and gas, natural gas resources in the region.
What is clear is the fact that the Israeli aggression against Palestinians cannot end through dialogue. Israel has defied calls to stop violating the rights of Palestinians for decades. Many factions in Palestine have also come to the conclusion that Israel can be pushed back only through resistance, and that any effort short of resistance will come to nothing given Washington's all-out support for the Israeli regime at the UN Security Council, the only world body that can issue a binding resolution against the regime.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to Q&A on Islamic Beliefs. I'm your host, Haider al-Bahadli, and today we have our dear esteemed guest, Sayyid Muhsin Naqawi. Sayyid, salamun alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah.
Thanks. How are you, Sayyid?
Alhamdulillah, thank you.
Sayyid, we have another very hot topic and a question regarding, equality between the genders. The question is as follows. Why does women in Islam get a lesser share of inheritance than a man does? Isn't that oppression?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, first of all, we need to know the role of man and woman in this world. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when He has created us, He created us in two forms, male and female. Wherever there is a duty of socializing with the people or socializing outside, working and hard working, Allah gave these duties to men. And therefore He said you need to provide sustenance for your family members. On the other hand, where there was the duty of training kids, to train kids to become a good person in the society, a good politician, a good poet, for example, a good writer, a good scholar. So these things are put on the shoulders of the woman, being a mother. And He gave this duty to the woman. Now, unfortunately, obviously, in this time, we see like the duties are being exchanged. The society that we are looking at, in which we do not see good people, good ethical people, is because the mothers are no more being attentive to their kids.
They're not invested in educating their kids anymore.
Yeah, huh? They're not educating. They're not basically looking after them the way they should. They're not teaching them the basic ethics which they need. And that's why in the society we have these issues. That's the first thing. The second thing is that Islam has given the the most of the rights to the women. And the rights which are given, it is justly, because Islam is the religion of just. It's not the religion of equality. There's a difference in the equality and justice. Equality and justice is, for example, if someone is working 1 hour, a clay man, for example, is working for 1 hour, and there is another clay man who's working for 10 hours, the equality says, the rule of equality says, give both of them equal wage. Whereas the rule of justice says, give him the money of 1 hour, give that person the money for 10 hours, because he has worked more. So Islam is the religion of justice. On top of that, we can see like the structure of the male and female. The male body structure is stronger than the female's.
The natural.
The natural. We're talking about the body structure of the man and female. So the duty of bringing sustenance and working outside, this is on the shoulders of man, and training people, like training the kids, brought up, which is the hardest duty, I think, which a man cannot do. It's just a woman who can do this, like brought up a kid or a child. It's not in the hands of man's to do this. The way mothers does it, the way child listen to his mother, he never listens to the father this
exactly.
way. And the father do not have that stamina and patience which mother have.
Exactly.
You know?
That's true. That is true.
There are many videos you can see like on the internet that when the kids are left with the father, what happens, what they're doing with the kids, and when they're next to mother, how they're living. So basically we need to accept all these things. There is no doubt that this woman can go out and work like a man.
Exactly.
There's no doubt in it. But the point is, this is not her duty.
She's not lesser qualified.
No, she's
she
not.
Might even be better than
Allah has given the capacity of doing everything to her as well. But obviously this is not her duty. Her duty is to deal with the kids, with the patience, with the love. And these are
creating the new nation, bringing Ahsan, it up, the new generation.
This is a big duty, like brought up a new generation on the good, like grounds. This is very, this is a big duty, and that's what we're looking for. Why we send our kids to the schools is to learn, not just learning ABC, for example, or calculating 1, 2, 3, but rather to learn some ethics as well, to deal with the people.
To become a good citizen.
To become a good citizen in the society, yes. Mm-hmm. So these are the duties of mother, basically, which obviously they have forgotten. Now, on the other hand, it's the man's duty to bring sustenance. So therefore, Islam divides the rules according to the just. Right? Mm. The division is according to the just.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
So how does this apply?
That's the first part of this question, that it's not on the basis of equality, because equality does not answer in any grounds. Mm. So we need to be just, because Allah is just. Now, how does this apply on the inheritance? In inheritance, Allah has justly given the portions in inheritance. Male, because he has to go out and bring sustenance for the whole family, for wife and kids as well. So he has to get more because he's struggling more. And then he can, if he wants to invest somewhere or working, so he needs that.
From an Islamic perspective, it's his obligation.
It's an obligation from Islamic perspective, yes. Yeah. On the other hand, woman, because she's at home, she had a husband. Mm. The husband is bringing all the sustenance.
Exactly.
She's not working. Therefore, there is
a less share.
So that's from one perspective answer. The other perspective is because people do not know about the rulings of inheritance, that's why they say ladies or women are getting less share than men.
Before we dive into this, let me just understand this correctly, that the man is obligated to spend his money that he inherits on his family, on his wife, on his daughters, on his sisters and mothers. He's obligated to do so. But the daughter of a deceased father, is not obligated to spend a nickel
on
her brother, on her father, on her husband, on her sons. It's for herself.
Yes.
So that's why she gets a lesser share.
That is also for the man. That portion is also for the man. But obviously he has a family where he has to spend. He cannot keep everything for himself like it's from my father.
So he gets something. Like, let's say that he gets $100. He must spend it on his family, on the females from his family, and his sons and his brothers. I'm not sure about brothers. His fathers, his parents, and his sons and daughters and wife, of course. But if the female gets a share, $50, she gets half of it. She's not obligated to spend $1, not even on herself. Yes. Is that right? She can keep it for herself.
Yeah, it's for her. And that's the main difference. Like the man, basically, he is, we can say, like mazlum. How we can call
so it. He is like being oppressed here.
Yes, yeah. He's been oppressed.
Gets $100 that he must use on them.
He must use and he has to like spend it on his family. He's basically dividing and he's using that for his family. Whereas the lady, there's no obligation on lady. You know, the way man has the obligation to bring sustenance in the family, there is no obligation on lady. If the woman is working...
Even if she's rich?
Yes, whatever.
Even if she's rich.
No matter whatever she has.
Not even her parents?
Even if she's working. For example, if there's a couple, the male and female both are working, the male, from the Islamic perspective, he has to sustain or bring food for the house from the money which he's earning. The female, if she's earning, that's all for her.
This is not an ethical obligation. This is a lawful obligation.
Yes, lawful obligation. Obviously, we're talking about the law.
Wajib shara'an.
Yes, wajib and shara'an, like from sharia point of view. But ethically, if she's obviously contributing, that's another ethically, like we can say, like it's ethically she should do to help the husband. So that's one perspective. The other perspective is people do not know about the rulings of inheritance. For example, in inheritance, it is said like the person who is dying, he can specify 1/3 of his wealth, that portion, 1/3 of the portion of his wealth, to anyone he wants. Now, if husband is giving that one-third portion to the wife, mm-hmm. she's getting more than the kids.
Exactly.
If a person has $100, and generally we know that the 8th person is for the wife.
One-eighth is for the wife.
And
those
then
kids.
The 2 parts for the boy and 1 part for the girl. A person who have 4 kids, 2 boys, 2 girls, and a wife. Mm. Now, generally they say like, oh, wife is getting 1/8. The mother is getting 1/8.
She's getting less than the
less
children.
Than the others. Now, if we can count, 1/8 of the $100 is...
1/8 of 80 to make it easier. I'm not sure if it's becoming
easier. Let's make
easier.
It from $100.
From $100, how much
from $100, just make 1/8.
It's 8.
No, it's divided in 8 portions, yes. So
$12
goes to the wife, number one.
Yes.
Then the husband is giving 1/3 of his wealth to the wife.
As well.
So it adds on that 8 portion which she has.
Yes.
Okay. And after that, what is left, then we need to make, for example, if it is 2 boys, they will make like 4 portions. And plus
girls.
2 girls will be 6.
So she will get almost half of it. Just
yes.
to, I don't want to confuse the listeners.
Yes.
She will get almost
because
half
one third,
of the inheritance.
Yes. 1/3 is obviously 33,
three,
for example,
and then
plus 12.
1/8, 12, exactly. And then the kids, the 4 kids.
It's 45.
They will
so she's getting 45 out of 100.
Yeah.
And
she will get a lot
for
more.
The kid. Basically, we need to know the inheritance rulings as well. The main point in this is we just look at the... You know, the outer face of the rule. The rule says 1/8 is for the wife, for example, or half is for the daughter.
Mm.
If there is a man who have only 2 kids, a boy and a daughter, there is another way to give. So if we want to give more portion to the woman,
mm-hmm.
there are ways. You know, Islam does not say like from you have to just give 1/8 to the woman, to the wife, and you cannot give anything else.
It's not like that. So we shouldn't take the rules out of context. And it goes back again to what we were talking about in a previous episode. It goes back to ignorance and people not understanding that the rules of Islam is rules made to create justice in society,
you know,
not equality.
The main problem is because we all are ignorant, that's why we are wrongly interpreting the Islam. We need to first get the knowledge of Islam. We need to know the rulings of Islam. We need to know Quran at least. What does it say? And after that, try to judge something. With the ignorance, when we say, obviously that will spread these kind of things, like Islam has no equality, it's all not on the basis of equality, or the Islamophobia, the way we like mentioned in the previous program. It's all because of the ignorance.
Exactly. Very, very precious advice that we hope we can abide by. Sayyid Mohsen. Sayyid, thank you very much. This is your host Haider Al-Bahadi from your program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs. Fi amanillah.
Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. Li Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لا نخشى المحن.
Ministry The Yemeni resistance Ansarullah have refused to put down their weapons and enter any Saudi proposed talks before the full cessation of the Saudi war and the lift of all forms of blockade against the Yemeni nation. The Saudi plan supposedly includes a UN-supervised ceasefire, measures to reopen Sana'a airport in the Yemeni capital, and the lifting of trade restrictions on the Ansarullah-controlled Hudaydah port, but with a twist. The Saudis want to control the airport and the seaport themselves, while also sharing revenues on trade in oil through Hudaydah. Mohammed bin Salman wants to snatch through politics what he was not able to achieve through 6 years of extensive warfare against Yemen. For the Yemeni resistance, the devil is in the details. The Saudi aim is clear: control of vital Yemeni port of entries after they successfully suffocated the nation, leading it to become the world's